We all know that women are not funny. And no one proves it better than Kay Ballard, the accidental lawyer who is the accidental host of our show. Of course, every accident that Kay Ballard encounters is intentional. And now her intention is to accidentally disprove the show's premise. So sit back and enjoy a fun conversation that matters between Kay and today's fabulous featured guest. Welcome to Women Are Not Funny Radio.
Oh, hello. This is Kay Ballard, and you've been waiting for this day, I know, because for the first time in the history of Women Are Not Funny Radio, we're going to talk about something important. I mean something truly important, probably the most important thing in the whole wide world, and that is fashion. We're going to be talking about fall fashion with Michelle McCormick of Love the Cool. And she is perfectly suited to be a part of this conversation because she was actually a stylist and photography assistant for Vogue magazine, among many other upscale magazines that we all read and love. So we're going to be talking about the September issue of Vogue. We're also going to be talking about fashion in general, fall fashion, surely, but fashion in general, and about the glammed up fashion life that she led. Now, she's currently the owner of her own company, Love the Cool, which is a consulting firm to clients, a very diverse client base. And so I know you're going to want to hear more about that. First, a couple of announcements, though. For this show, we have a cool little dress-up fashion game, and it features some of the fall fashions from Vogue magazine. I want you to go there because I love it. It's on my blog, newmediamartini.com/Vogue is where you'll find the game. Or you can just go to New Media Martini and hit the Vogue tab up top. And three of the outfits from this month's Vogue are featured there. Also, I want to direct you to Women Are Not Funny's channel on YouTube. You see, I must be proving that women are not funny because I keep hiring these teams of little young male videographers who make these funny videos for this show. But we have a new one up, and it's actually very cute. It's 2 minutes long, so I'd love for you to watch it. Well, Michelle McCormick has been an online friend of mine for a very long time. She lives in Boston, and this is where she has settled after a career that involved a lot of very glamorous worldwide travel. And the reason I say glamorous is because she was working for these different magazines, and she would be sent to every photogenic place in the world for photo shoots. So she's in Boston now, and I think Boston can be a pretty glamorous place. We'll find out about that. But before I can have any kind of serious conversation, there are a couple of things I need to find out. Michelle, are you using this appearance on Women Are Not Funny Radio as a stepping stone to something better?
Hi, Kay. I actually am. Time-wise, I'm using it as a stepping stone to this really amazing date I'm going to have tonight that I'm really psyched about.
Well,
it's a first date with this guy that, like, I totally dig, and I told him that I'm going to be on the show, and I think that, like, kind of impressed him, right?
Well, know what? There's very little more impressive than being the featured guest on Women Are Not Funny Radio.
Exactly.
I mean, some people think doing the halftime show at the Super Bowl is, you know, kind of a big gig. But being on Women Are Not Funny Radio is major. So I would tonight, you really will, and he'll want to know about me, Michelle, you know.
Oh, you know, that's all the other, about you.
Yeah, that's the other way, you know, you can impress him is let him know me. But here's the other thing I worry about a little bit. And do not by any chance think I'm paranoid to mention it. I'm not. I mean, I have a lot of self-confidence for good reason, but by any chance, are you here essentially to audition to take over the show?
Oh, of course not. I don't think I'm a radio person. I could never do your job, Kay. How could anyone do your job? You're much more positive than I mean, I strive for that.
Yeah,
but
good question. It's such a prestigious, you know, job that there have been people here, Michelle, there have been featured guests who have been very, very transparent about their desire to take over the show. And so that's kind
of,
you know, I hate to say it, but it's true. But anyway, I'm glad to hear that you don't fall into that category.
Yep, you're safe with me.
How do you feel about the September issue of Vogue? Are you like me? Is it one way that you know that fall has really arrived?
Sure. That and Fashion Week, of course. In person and on the glossy, for sure. Absolutely.
Well, you know, there have been times in my life when I've been very, very, very trendy. And now I like to think I'm more, you know, in the category of the person setting the trends. Of course, there are those who would argue. There are those who would argue. My joke has been that I like to look at Vogue so I'll know what I'll be wearing 5 years from now, because they are generally pretty fashion forward. Would you agree with that?
You know what, Kay? I have to say that, like, because I read so many really fashion forward magazines. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that they're, like, necessarily 5 years ahead. I think they definitely, like, they're on almost just on the cutting edge. Like, I think that Vogue, like, lifts from the street. And there are a lot of magazines that are, like, more aligned with, like, the street, like, really starting it. You know, magazines. And so, you know, Vogue, the reason why Vogue is so successful in Anna Wintour is that, like, they're able to they're on that fine line of being like cutting edge and very commercial. They have to be to sell for the advertisers.
Well, I totally agree with
that.
I totally agree with that. I subscribe to something you may be familiar with, Lookbook, and that is definitely street fashion and very cool. The young people from all across the world who dress themselves, photograph themselves, and appear in that blog. Don't you like that?
Oh, absolutely. .nu, lookbook.nu. It's fantastic.
I'll have to check that out. The thing that listeners should know is that Michelle blogs at lovethecool.net. Her company name is Love the Cool, and she is a digital strategist, but one of the things that she brings to the space, which I think is, if not unique, it is certainly unusual. Michelle is an art collector. Michelle is a photographer. Michelle is into the fashion scene, both from her past career and just from her interest. She's an aesthete. And she's particularly interested in the way that new media and social media interacts with fashion. And one of the things that we talked about in our pre-production meeting, and we've talked about it before, is just kind of my fascination with the fact that there's not more attention paid to that, because it really, really is interesting to see and think about how social media influences fashion and how fashion influences social media. And I think this is a space that Michelle has carved out for herself, and I love it.
Thank you, Kay. I also, that's why, you know, we're called Love the Cool, and, we're heavily focused on, you know, tech and social media, fashion, and music. And, like, what's cooler than those subjects? Like, I really don't think anything is. So we're really, you know, we're lucky. We, like, come to this space, I think, with, like, a lot of authenticity because we have a lot of passion for it. What I think is fascinating about what's happening with fashion right now, or at least in, like, the past, not even just right now, in the past year, is how, like, luxury brands, high fashion, is having to, like, compromise. Like, they never did before. They refused to compromise in the past. They didn't want to engage with the general public. But because of social media and the economy, there are a lot of factors. Couture brands are having to, engage the general public, start Facebook fan pages. The Burberry Art of the Trench website is, like, a perfect example of, like, you know, like, Burberry reaching out to, like, the general consumer. Like, when you see people, like, fashion designers like Yohji Yamamoto, like, claiming bankruptcy, and Christian Lacroix, like, there's nothing, they really can't do anything but, you know, compromise at this point. And you know what Anna Wintour did with the September issue of the documentary it was very, like, you would have never seen her do a documentary 10 years ago, but the reason why she's so brilliant, one of the many reasons, is that she sees that. She sees that, like, no longer can you be exclusive in the space. Like, the internet is, like, the democratization of almost everything right now. And, like, you can't be exclusive. You have to, like, engage. And that means talking to the riffraff. That means talking, you know what I mean? Like, what they used to would have thought that way. And I think that's beautiful. Love that.
Well, I do too. And the movie is something that I had known about. It came out a year ago. I forgot about it and was reminded about it by you and your blog, Michelle. And so I watched it streaming from Amazon, and I absolutely loved it. And, of course, you know, I think, don't you think, obviously, her willingness to do it was part of the response, if you will, to being portrayed as she was in The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even think of that, Kay. I'll have to think about that. I never even thought of it that way, because I don't know. Did you see Devil Wears Prada?
I sure did.
Oh, you did? Okay. I really believed that she did it because they needed to get this. Literally, they needed to make sure. They wanted to make sure the September issue of that year really sold it. I think they felt like she had to.
Well, whatever her reason was, I'm glad she did. It was a real interesting insight. And, you know, my belief was that it was fairly objective, but who knows? Now, one of my friends had emailed me about this show, and she said she called herself the armchair Anna Wintour, and I thought that was great. And she was talking about how she feels as she's looking at Vogue, but she was not too impressed with the September issue, and I think we have no choice but to tell everyone that you haven't been able to pick it up. Michelle, this year, it has 728 pages, which I think that's down by at least 20%.
That I live in Boston and I can't get the September issue, and like that's really unusual. Like, it's not as available. Vanity Fair is not even there. I really don't think, like, the regular stores, like the CVSs and stuff like that are carrying it. You have to go to Borders. Do you remember, like, 5 years ago? Like, you could get the Vogue anywhere.
You know what? I had a hard time. I had a hard time myself. I did actually buy mine at CVS. So there's some at some CVS stores because I bought one there. But it's been a long time since I've bought, you know, a magazine, because I normally subscribe. But it was interesting to me because about 200 little subscribe cards fell out of it, and I thought, why do they do so many? You know, have they done research to show that the fifth card you don't fill it out and send it in, but the sixth one you do? I mean,
no,
I wonder about that.
No, exactly. I'm kind of glad this happened because it really shows me like there's a distribution issue. I never really thought of it because I honestly, Kay, I consume almost everything online, or on podcasts or on my iPhone. I don't buy paper much anymore. So it didn't even occur to me that I wouldn't be able to pick up the September issue because, you know, as I said, I just got back from the U.S. Open last night, so I didn't have time to get it yesterday, and it didn't even occur to me I'd have a problem getting it. So it was
interesting
commentary on like the distribution issues of like the magazine industry right now.
But that's a fascinating point, Michelle, because we hear that the industry is in trouble, but it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. If it's not out there for you to buy, then you're not going to be buying them. And so, having looked at this issue both online and in print, they're very different. They're very, very different. And I actually have to say I prefer the online.
Really?
And yeah, I do. And I think part of that is because I do so much online now. I do so much of my reading there. I'm just really more accustomed to it. But, you can, you know, you can very quickly, for example, the ready-to-wear collection is 100 pages, and you can flip through very quickly and see what you're interested in, see what you like. And I don't know if you've seen my little dress-up game, but actually three of the outfits from the magazine and one of the Chanel handbags are part of that dress-up game. It's so funny. I just love it. But anyway, let me tell you about some of the trends that Vogue has identified. And I agree with you. They're not 5 years ahead of fashion. That's my little joke. But they are, you know, they do. I agree with you. They're, I think you really nailed it. They're kind of in between. They're a little bit on the edge, but not a whole lot.
Not too much.
Go ahead.
So, I was going to say, not too much to alienate advertisers, but
yeah,
they're not too cutting edge.
Yeah, in fact, more of their ads are cutting edge than their fashions. But one of the trends appears to be for coats, plaid coats. And, you know, when I saw that, I actually thought of you because you're someone who could wear a plaid coat. In fact, you're someone I think would wear a plaid coat because you like plaid,
don't
you? I
do wear one. I do.
Yeah.
I like plaid. It's my favorite color. No, I'm just
kidding. So, well, plaid coats are going to be a big trend this fall, according to Vogue. Also, lace. Anything with lace. And I think that's cool, and I was looking at that. And it appears to me that if someone has a dress they love, they could simply have lace applique on it, and they would be, you know, it'd be a new dress. But
nice.
I thought, I have a pink lace pocket square that I am going to wear with a black leather jacket. And then I thought, you know, would anyone see that and think, oh, my goodness, she's right with trend? Or would they say, what is a pink lace pocket square doing in the pocket of a black leather jacket? What do you think?
That would look totally cool, especially if the black leather jacket was, like, fitted. But that would look awesome. You mean, like, a little handkerchief?
Just like a little pocket square of pink lace.
Oh,
I just happened to think of that.
As long as it's working, okay.
So the sweater section I liked. The sweaters were mostly close to the body, and, you know, I'm a fan of cashmere sweaters. They were very classic cashmere sweaters. A few cables, and then it appears that sweater coats, you know, what do you say? Do you say that they are big this year? Aren't sweater coats really kind of big every year?
Yeah, and I'm not a fan at all. I just
really
don't think they look good. No, I don't ever think they look good. No,
well,
but
what if it were a Stella McCartney cardigan and you were wearing it on the beach?
On the beach? with a bikini and Hawaii. Of course, I would always be fabulous, sure.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. You know, you just have to put it in context. Well, it appears that long shaker sweaters. This is one thing I saw that I loved, absolutely loved this expression. There was a full page photo, and it was the woman sitting in kind of an unusual position. She was wearing a long tunic, shaker style tunic, with a long elegant silk brocade skirt, and they called it a witty combination. And I thought, boy, that phrase is great. If you can just put anything together and have people consider it a witty combination, wouldn't that be lovely?
Hey, what is a shaker sweater? What does that mean, shaker? Like,
well,
a shaker sweater type of thing?
It's not cables, but it's kind of like stripes. So it is.
Yep.
You know, it's a very plain knit, but it's not a flat knit, and it's kind of an aggressive knit. So, you know, but that's one of the things that I'm curious about. We know that these trends recycle, recirculate, but some of them take years and years to come back around, and some come back in 2 years or 3 years. How does that?
Yep.
What do you think about that?
Well, I'm looking at something right now, like the pea coat apparently is back too, and that thing just keeps coming in style, like every few years. Like people don't get
How do you feel about peacoats? Oh, I absolutely do. I have several. How do you feel about them?
I guess I'm done with them. Like, I loved them, like, in the late 90s. I remember that. Like, I loved them, and I loved them on my – I had a roommate, Jim, and he looked fabulous in his. But, like now I'm looking at this picture right now, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm done with that look. I don't know if I'll ever be ready for it again. I think that's it. It's over for me.
Well, you know what? If you have one that's cut well, they just look so fabulous on. I think that's why they're popular, is they,
yeah.
They're kind of a nice cut. But one of the things that supposedly is a big trend this year in handbags is the quilted bag. And I saw that and I said, that was 3 years ago. That was,
yeah.
they were a big trend 3 years ago. So now, only 3 years later, quilted bags are back. I mean, I was glad, right? Because I still have the quilted bags.
Yeah,
and
exactly. And Chanel has never gone out of style. It's always quilted, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely, and I think that's one, you know, that could be one reason, but there were, like, 3 years ago, it came on the scene, they were called Italian leathers, and they weren't leather. It was a patent, some of them were, but a lot of them weren't, but it was all referred to as Italian leathers, and they were quilted, and,
right,
you know, they were very sumptuous and also very sort of, what do I want to say, very flexible and squishy and soft and
yep.
nice. And so I have a bag that I love, and I'm glad to find out that it's, you know, big trend for this year. And certainly the Chanel handbag that is featured with my little dress-up doll, God knows how much that costs. It's probably $3,000 or so.
No kidding. Well, do you know what I think, Kay, as far as, like, fashion innovation? Like, it's really – I think it is obviously really difficult to, like, innovate with, like, you know, coats and sweaters and stuff like that. I think the true innovation moving forward is going to be functional fashion that is in response to technology. Like, and I'm serious. Like, stay with me here for a second, but, like – you know, like Google goggles, like the fact that, like, there's going to be, like really good facial recognition, so that if you're sitting on the train, somebody can take a picture of you, like covertly take a picture of you, search you on Google goggles, get all of your information inside of, like, 10 seconds. So imagine, like, when that really, like, matures. People, I do believe that there's – I want to believe that there's going to be, like, facial fashion, like headgear and, like – like, you know, like, when you even look at, like, Star Trek, like, old episodes of, like, any of the sci-fi, there's always, like, the women always have, like, these hats that, like the material goes down over the face, and usually it's, like, maybe a plastic or something. Can't you imagine how cool that would look? Like, now.
You know what? You are portraying things that are cool and also, to me, very scary, just the whole idea. You know, so you mentioned you're on a train with someone who's wearing, quote, Google goggles, and they can look at you. It does face recognition. They can find out all the information about you. That is very frightening, and particularly when you put it in a situation like a train where you're somewhat anonymous by preference, you know, if you're me.
And that's a fact. That's why I think fashion's going to become seriously functional in response to technology, because that is scary, but that exists right now.
It's, yeah.
You know, they can take a picture of you, and like Picasa is, like, they have a, Google has a pretty advanced facial recognition algorithm right now. So it's definitely, I believe, going to be, maybe it's at the beginning stages right now. Imagine in 10 years, 20 years. We have a whole set of issues that I think fashion will be part of, responding to.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I don't even want to go there. I'm just sitting here, you know, thinking, oh, my God, that does not sound like a good idea, not at all. But, you know, there. I agree with you. There's no stopping it. You know, I agree with you there. But your point about functional fashion. Earlier today, as I was thinking about this conversation, I was thinking about one of the things with my internet lifestyle, and I'm not currently traveling. I think a lot of listeners know that I'm somewhat grounded, and they assume that the reason I'm grounded and unable to travel currently is because I am, you know, I have an ankle bracelet that I've been convicted of some crime, and I'm stopped by an ankle bracelet. That's not exactly the truth, but anyway, I was thinking about my lifestyle as an internet entrepreneur, and when I go back to a more active schedule of speaking and a more public schedule, you know, those are the times when you really want to look good. But actually, when I travel and speak, I wear these functional clothes because I also don't want to look wrinkled, you know?
Right.
And I had the experience where, I mean, this is the truth, no kidding. I was speaking at an event. I was the luncheon speaker, and she was the morning keynote speaker, Olympia Dukakis. And so when I went over to meet her, it was just kind of weird because we were both wearing the same outfit.
Are you serious?
I am serious.
That is awesome.
And what we were wearing was, well, she looked better. She had on boots, and it looked better with boots. But and she's a movie star, you know, and I'm just a major international celebrity. But she had on this black stretchy outfit with a, you know, with a shell and a black stretchy tunic. And that's exactly what I had on as well. And so we just, it's just strange. But this is kind of a, you know, this is not an unusual thing for someone on the speaker's circuit. But, you know, that is really when you want to look glamorous is when you're traveling, but there's this other thing called wrinkles and carrying all your things and messing with accessories and so forth. It's just a lot of work that you don't want to do, so it's really kind of tough, don't you think?
But I have, because I traveled so much in the past with my job when I was a photographer and a photo assistant and all that, like I have methods that I pack. I'm a really good packer. So I, like, lay all my stuff out and I roll it. You know that trick, right?
I do know that trick.
Okay, good. So it will, and it really works well. And usually my stuff, like, I wear very fitted clothes almost all the time. So it's not so difficult for me in that way. But, yeah, there's, like, little tricks that you learn when you're, like, constantly on the road with work. And you have to look good. You know, you have to, like, wear, you know, appropriate clothes if you're going to have dinner at night and stuff like that. So, little tricks like that.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. In your former career as a, I assume you were you employed actually employed by the magazines or were you employed by the photographers?
It depends. I was freelance, so I was an independent contractor, so I would get hired by the photographer, the magazine. I worked in film too, so it was different. I had a lot of different roles. When I was really traveling around the world, I was mostly a photo assistant and stylist.
So when you were doing that work, was it important for you to look fashionable?
It's funny. It's kind of like how I am now in a way, but it's just the way I always dressed, like kind of, you know, street culture, like clothes. I was, you know, at that time I was living in New York. I was a club kid as well. So, like, my work, it all is, and it kind of is the same thing today. Like, it's all the same. I don't dress for work. I dress the way I dress. You know that, Kay, right? Like, just, like, it's just cool clothes. And I guess I'm lucky that I've been able to, like, choose a professional, you know, where, and I have my own business now that I'm able to do that.
Well, I totally agree. And
I used to wear, like, platforms to, you know, work, like, when I was traveling around, you know, like, I'd wear whatever I really wanted to, but I would have to look cool. I think when you're working in that industry, I know when you work in that industry, it's important that you embrace the culture, right? And, like, actually have a passion for it, which I do, which is fashion and music and, like, what's going on now, especially, like what I said about, like, the street. Like, at that time, I was in the club scene. So I was actually kind of, like, even a little bit more ahead. So I had, like, kind of I dressed kind of crazy, I guess. And people like that when you're working in that field. It's inspiring.
Oh, I agree. And it's fun. You know, there's no getting around it. It's just fun. But, you know, speaking of the club scene, you still are into the music, and several of your clients are musicians. And I want to play our listeners a piece by Jay Veal, one of your clients, and it's 4 a.m. Tell Me Why.
It's 4 a.m.
Where you can get downloads of all of the cuts from what he's calling a free album. So tell us a little bit about Jayville.
Oh, he's a new artist. He's most of his music is actually is rap, and we signed with him about a month ago, and we're actually promoting his music. Our other musician client is a rapper, and we do his social media. So this is kind of a departure for us, but it's really exciting. We're like getting Jayville booking him, you know, around Boston and New York City. He's already done a show with Sweezy, which is he's a really great rapper, and so he's young and he's amazing. His work is really good. This kid is like, he's 18 and he's really hitting it.
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed listening to his pieces, and the reason I selected that one, even though it isn't terribly representative of his work, I like the whole 4 a.m. aspect, because Michelle, you and I have spent some 4 a.m.s together.
Totally. I thought you remember that. Like, oh, those are the days I couldn't sleep. I'm in bed by midnight these days. But
yeah,
I'm so comforting, though. Isn't it nice, Twitter, having like this network? It was really nice. I liked that.
Yeah, it really is fun, and getting to know you is just, you know, has been just a delightful thing for me. But we've known each other a long time now in under a variety of circumstances, and it's so fun. But I have just enjoyed watching you create your business, and part of what is so terrific about it is the clients that are a good fit for you. They're quite diverse, but they're all very with it people. They're all very cool people. And one of the things that I would like listeners to know about your blog, it's just a treat for me. I subscribe to it, and so typically I'm going to get a post every night in my inbox around midnight, and it's a great blog, Michelle, for people who don't even like to read, because your posts are short and sweet, and you just point us to things we might want to know about, and videos and different web pages and different trends. And I just love your blog. It's one of my favorite things.
Thank you so much. That means a lot, Kay. I really appreciate that. It's interesting. I love it. I love it being the face of our company.
Yeah.
Basically, we just write about what we love.
Yeah, you know? You write some about your work for your clients, and it's always, you know, it's always fascinating. So, did you by any chance watch the Emmy Awards on Sunday night?
No, I did not. Tell me why.
I didn't either. You know, because I don't watch TV.
I don't have TV either.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not a TV snob, I just don't do it, but I did see photographs of all of the Emmy clothes, which really are kind of the most interesting thing to me at this point, and it looks like to me, certainly, the trend for the Emmys was one-shoulder dresses, you know, it's like every third dress, one-shoulder. What do you think about that?
Oh, that can be really hot. I have a shirt like that. You have got to, like, have the right body type for it, right? Don't you think? For any kind of straplessness. I mean,
well,
anyone can wear it.
Here's what I think. When every third dress at some event is one shoulder, then it's just too much. You know, it's just too much. But how do you protect yourself from that?
You
don't know what everyone else is going to wear. But the other thing I have to say, and I think it's probably pretty controversial, but if you are fat and ugly, stay home. Just stay home.
No. But you can work that. But, like, I think the right clothing, you have to wear the right clothing to work that.
I would say something different then. I would say, okay, don't stay home. But if you are someone, no, this is what I'd say. Okay, if you are fat and ugly and you are someone that they're going to put a camera in front of you, stay home. Because you can go if no one's going to photograph you. But let me tell you who, and she's not ugly and she's not really fat, but one of the people who got an F+ grade for her dress, and she was wearing Prada, it was Rita Wilson, Tom Hanks' wife. And it was horrible looking. I mean, it was just horrible looking. The dress was. And she did not look good in it. So what do you do? I mean, how does that happen? How do you think that happens?
Yeah.
That people buy something, you know, it cost a fortune.
Yep.
You know she thought it looked good. You know she didn't say, oh, my God, this is so ugly. This is what I'm wearing to the Emmys. You know she didn't say that. So how could something like that happen?
What happens a lot in entertainment, you see it happen at the Emmys and the Oscars. And, you know, I really don't want to diss anyone, but, like, it's people don't, a lot of times, like, I think actors don't necessarily have, like, the fashion sense of style that, like you know, you have in New York. Like, you're looking more like L.A. and stuff, and, like, it's, they're depending largely on stylists and not a personal style. Like, you do, so often you see people, like, you know, roll out on the red carpet wearing really inappropriate clothing that you know is not something that they've, like, cultivated a look and, you know, they haven't cultivated their own look and feel of, like, what their personal style would be. They're, like depending on wardrobe to do it for them. Because everyone has it inside, and they just haven't tapped into it yet.
Okay, Michelle, that's so interesting to me that you're saying that, because I thought it was just the opposite. I thought that the people who look good are the ones that are employing a stylist, and the people who look less good are not.
I think the opposite. I do think the opposite, definitely. Like, if you look at, you know, even like Michelle Obama, like sometimes she looks good a lot, but every once in a while she'll have something on. I just know it's a stylist. Like, so often, like, people will wear things that, like, it doesn't make any sense that they have it on. And, like, and I don't think that, like, if you cultivate your own personal style, that, because all, I think we, you know, maybe I'm optimistic, but all human beings have, like, a personal style. And all you have, if you can tap into that, like, and work it, then it would come off as being natural. You can tell when people just are not doing it and they're depending on others to dress them.
Well, I guess so. The thing that I'm very curious about, your opinion about this, I am not a big fan of evening gowns and casual hair.
Oh, casual hair and evening gowns. You know what? You can work anything if you really work it. If you mean it when you do it, I think. But when you say casual hair, like not like something that's, you know, just like loose and hanging down.
Yeah,
mainly
that.
You prefer out the bun. Yeah.
No, I just mean just loose and hanging down. You know, just not,
yeah.
Not, you know, if you're in a ball gown, to me, I want to see some hairspray. Okay, I want to see it. I want the hairspray so thick
right.
It actually is visual. You know, here she comes. She's wearing her hair and her hairspray.
Yeah. Have you ever seen anyone like be somewhat ironic in something like that and to pull it off? Like, you have to have a good personal. You have to have a really, like, good personal sense of style to pull off irony and fashion. You have to mean it and, like, you know, be authentic when you're doing it.
Well, I agree, but there's another possibility that just springs to my mind. You could have someone walk out ahead of you holding a sign saying she's being ironic. Or, you know, or pass out little flyers that say, you know, she is wearing this very sophisticated ball gown with her casual hair because it is a witty combination.
Exactly, witty. There's that again. Yep, sounds good.
I think, you know,
but whatever.
Just to make sure that people understand. Well, one of the things that one of my friends pointed out, and I would like to say, I'm going to give a shout out to this friend. Darling, it looks like to me, from examining the pages of Vogue, that you can pull out your gold Prada ballet flats, because they have some Chanel gold ballet flats that are featured that are very similar.
Yep.
So that's just a little fashion, you know, hint that could make you feel good. Anyway, she's pointed out that a lot of the styles were reminiscent of Halston, which I think is very true. And, in fact, one of the dresses that my dress-up doll is wearing kind of puts me in mind of a Halston. So what do you think? Is it time to revive Halston, bring him back from the dead, or should we just let him go away?
Oh, bring him back. I love his little cocktail dresses.
There's
nothing like that. And, like, in the 70s, what about, like, those, like, Halston dresses? Or gowns with, like loose 70s hair. That looks really cool. Like, cleavage.
Yeah.
And I love that.
He, you know, really for a period of time, not only were his clothes very cool, but he was the epitome of cool, you know?
He was like the whole Studio 54 scene, having a blast. Right? The glory days.
So how did it happen? Give us some idea about how you got started in the fashion industry. How did you at such a young age?
Biggest thing? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. How'd you do it, hon?
Well, the easiest, the biggest step is just to move to New York. And that's what I did. I lived in the Village. I went to school at School of Visual Arts, and before I was done with school, I started working for magazines and photographers, and it's just built on itself. You know, it was my lifestyle, it was a culture thing, and it was the people I hung out with did the same thing, and we all like worked in I was a bartender for a while before I did that. You know, I worked in clubs, and then there were times. I was doing both things, you know, just to like, you know, young, living in New York, making money, and freelancing in magazines, and then I eventually, you know, started, working enough, getting enough jobs and making enough contacts that I was able to do it full time, and I was traveling around the world. It was really, when you're working like that, you're working at 120% all the time, and it's cool. Like, I, like, really honed my work ethic when I was – those are high – I mean, it's pretty high pressure, you know, like, doing a photo shoot in Africa, like, on safari in Africa for 3 weeks, and, like, I was a photo assistant on that job, and, like, that's a lot of money that the magazine is thinking into sending us over there, and, like, if anything goes wrong, it's, like, a big problem. You know, like, from the minute we get there till the minute we land in New York and, like, get the photos back from the lab or, you know, you have to make sure you're at 120%. Like, nothing can go wrong, really. So it was really exciting. And then eventually, you know, I ended up working in film. I was a prop stylist for commercials and stuff like that. And then eventually I really wanted to start, like, I had a lot of friends that were designers. And I wanted to, like do something more like visually creative. And I also wanted to, like, my whole thing has always been like owning a magazine. I don't know that I'll ever do that because like the magazine industry is kind of gutted, but I love the idea of being able to at least be able to have the skill set to create a magazine if I ever wanted to, which I ended up doing, you know, like I ended up leaving, not freelancing anymore and going to school for a little while for Photoshop, Illustrator. And then learned graphic design and eventually web. This is like in the early 2000s, web 1.0, like around that time. I moved to London. I started a new media company with a boyfriend. And, you know, it's just like it snowballed from there. And then I came back to Boston and right at the height of like 2.0, I guess 2005, and I worked at an ad agency as a producer, interactive producer. After a year, I decided to go out on my own, and, like, this is it. This is social media now. You know, I understand all of the steps up till right now. I was a flash designer. I was an HTML designer. I was a graphic designer. You know, really thick offline experience. I was a black and white printer for Andy Leibovitz. And when I was a photo assistant, we were doing, like, serious, like, film. We weren't doing digital. We were, like, setting up lights, and I was loading, like, actual film and cameras. So, I have a lot of experience that has allowed me to right now basically do just social media stuff but understand the whole process, and it's
fabulous what you bring to it. It really is. And I have to say, in some respects, your blog is magazine-like, and I can definitely see you as the editor-in-chief of a magazine, because you do have that ability to pull content from a lot of areas and to, you know, be right on the pulse of things and know what people want to see and read about. So I would encourage you, you know, in that direction, absolutely.
But you
bring up another interesting point, interesting to me, certainly, who wants to, you know, I lead the life of a celebrity and have for many years, but I'm always curious about other people in the celebrity space, and you know so many. You blogged not too long ago about the fact that Deborah Harry herself used to be one of your buddies and used to come to your apartment from time to time.
Yep. She wasn't my buddy, but she was my roommate. Blondie, or Debbie Harry, but Blondie, like the band, they would all store their equipment at our loft on 14th Street in the Meatpacking District. And I was subletting that space renting a part of the space out from this woman, Gretchen, who was 20 years older. She was around, Blondie's age, and she was a musician. And it was this huge space, this huge loft in the Meatpacking District, 3,000 square feet, I don't know, a lot. And I would live there with a friend. And we would have parties, you know, every week. And, like, occasionally Debbie Harry would come over. It was cool because Gretchen was a serious musician, especially in, like, the 70s, I guess. I forget the name of the band. It was, like, a kind of well-known underground band. And she had played with Debbie Harry as well. And so, anyway, Debbie Harry would come over to our parties, and they would be on the bongos. Gretchen had, like, a huge grand piano in our place. She had, like, all this musical instruments all over the wall, like hand drums and bongos and like string instruments, and like everyone would just sit around and jam. It was such a blast. My mother was there a few times, and it's like she thinks of it as like the best time of her life. But yeah, it would be really cool. Like Debbie Harry would come up, and you know, would just all be chilling. It was fun.
Yeah. Well, do you miss New York? Tell me how Boston compares.
Oh, I miss New York a lot. I just got back last night from the city. You know, I came back here because my nephew was born, but, you know, Boston has changed a lot since the big dig is over. I never thought I would be okay with living here because I am, New York is home to me. I have always adored it there. I felt like I never wanted to leave. And then I ended up moving to London and then to Italy and stuff. And now that I'm back here in Boston, I'm a little older, and the big dig is done, and, like, there's so many amazing restaurants here and, like, bars and stuff like that. Like, it's actually and it's faster than it ever was before. I'm not saying that, like, I don't want to move back to New York, because I kind of do. I think that, like, business-wise, the opportunity is more there. Like, working on the net, I can, like, live anywhere. But, like, just, like, you know, I was at the U.S. Open the past 2 days, and I was able to do a lot of face-to-face business that, like, you know, I can do a lot of, as you know, KU, too, like, we can do a lot of business online, but, like, the face-to-face, like, when you pull that offline, it just seals it. And I just kind of feel like it would be a lot easier to do that in New York. But I'm not making any plans to leave anytime, like, very soon, but I wouldn't be surprised if I moved back in New York eventually. Clients there, you know, I could see it happen, but I love Boston.
Well, the funny thing is, I knew you for a long time before I realized you were in Boston. I just thought you were in New York. You know,
that's so funny, really.
Yeah, you definitely have a New York sensibility, and but Boston is not only a thriving and very interesting city; it's very big in the social media space. You know, and really in the forefront there. So in that respect, it's not a bad place for you to be. And you have so many, you're very creative, obviously, on a lot of different levels. You have so many different things going, a new business for producing coupons that, you know, I think it's just really genius, and I, you know, I want to see how that develops. I think it's very, very exciting. You are, we are sisters in this respect. We just are involved in a lot of different things, but there's so many opportunities that you just can't be blind to them.
Exactly. And you also have to be, you know, you have to be careful what you choose to, like, spend your time on. We also started Secret Boston, which is a fan page on Facebook, which, you know, we had 2,000 fans within the first month, and we're almost up to 7,000 right now. And all it is, it's like basically we created this platform for, like, people to write about whatever they want to about Boston. And what I love about it mostly is that first of all, the testing ground for us, like, we test a lot of, like, strategies that we'll use for our clients on Secret Boston and see how it works out with the community. But it's also, like, you know, in social media, everybody, even, like, especially on Facebook, people love the fact that it's private and they're friends, but they're also looking for, like, a platform to, like, be public and to have a voice. And I feel like we're providing that on Secret Boston. It's a really good spot for, like, and that's how the virtual coupon company actually came about, because so many businesses are coming to us and asking us to promote their stuff in the stream. We figured, you know, why not start a coupon generator for them to, like, go right there and we could monetize? Because we never really thought about monetizing Secret Boston other than, you know, we've definitely gotten clients to love the cool. It's good for, you know, it proves that we have success in the space. But the coupon company is, like, a good opportunity to actually monetize the community and also provide a service for them, like, for our fans. So.
Yeah, it's a terrific idea. And there's something, you know, there's something intriguing about Secret Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I love that name.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that name. Well, let's go back to fashion for just a moment. Our time together is winding down, but here's something I have to ask you about. You talked about just now your work for a PR firm, a major PR firm, and the work you did, digital work you did for their clients. I think one of your clients through them was Rockport. And in this month's Vogue, they have several pages, and It's amazing to me where they've gone in style. They actually call them, commuter boots, and they are platform boots with what you would have to consider a stiletto heel when it comes to a boot. And, you know, we know that Rockport is known for comfort, and I looked at those and I said, oh my goodness, could those actually be comfortable? They call them hot commute shoes. Have you seen those?
I'm looking right now, but I'm not surprised. Like, do you know why? Like, who wants to? I mean, they want to appeal. When I was at Hill Holiday and in doing microsites for Rockport, their goal was to become more cutting edge, and I think they must have. I'm sure they did some studies and figured out that like the demographic that their shoe was appealing to wasn't going to spend the money that they wanted, right? Which is like the hiking shoe,
right?
So I'm not surprised at all that they have a stiletto shoe. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it really is. It's a stiletto boot, and they look great. They look great. When I think of Rockports, they also obviously do shoes for men, and so
yep.
They would do things that weren't really hiking shoes, but sort of quasi dress shoes, you know, but comfort. And so, I found that totally shocking to see this sexy little boot, and it was a Rockport. And then my immediate thought is that it would be comfortable. Who knows? But you know, I'd certainly be willing to try.
Definitely. I remember when I was living in New York, I would like grab like a sneaker and like down in the East Village, they have stores that they'll make platforms out of any shoe you bring them. So you just bring like a comfortable sneaker and you have them make a platform and then you just have like these cool shoes to go out in. But like Easy Spirit, they started making like, you know, like quote unquote cool shoes, like trying to appeal to like I think they're trying to appeal to like school, young, you know, the 18 to 24 demographic, you know, so. That's who's spending money on stuff like that. So it makes
sense. Yeah, well, you know, I have a friend of sorts, actually an enemy on Twitter, Patty Dye, who you probably
know.
I think we ought to look into getting some orthopedic platforms for her. You know?
Orthopedic platforms, sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, if they can make them out of any shoe, we ought to be able to take some of her tacky orthopedic shoes and get them made into platforms.
That is so funny. I bet you mentioned her name every show that you do, don't you, Kay?
Well, you know what? I she loves the attention, and so I tried to give it to her. I told her today, and I said it in complete sincerity. I am going to buy a cat, name it Patty, and make it eat liver.
Really? What's her handle, her Twitter handle?
Her Twitter handle is at Patty Dye, and Dye is D-I-G-H, and just draw your own conclusions. So, Michelle, I just think you are the greatest, and I love the way that you bring fashion to me every single night through your blog, and I want to thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Kay. You always say the nicest things to me, and I really appreciate all your support. I really do. You're like a really, one of my favorite people online and in general. And we have to meet someday in person. That was a sweet bet.
Well, we absolutely do, but let's promise this. When we do get together, let's look good. What do you think?
Oh, my God. Of course, goes without saying.